You are Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast on the Houston Rockets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome back, everyone, to Locked On Rockets, your home for daily and post-game commentary on the Houston Rockets. I'm your host, Ben Dubose. As we chat on this Thursday, we're just 24 hours away from the Rockets finally resuming basketball activities. Imagine that. Well, I guess they did resume some activities yesterday and today with practice, but they're actually back to basketball games tomorrow night. Nationally televised ESPN home against the Minnesota Timberwolves kicks off the final 25-game stretch of the season. Rockets up by a game on the Warriors. I know it's a half game, but for all practical purposes, it's a full game with the tiebreaker that they hold and the being one game up in the loss column, so we get to see how they handle these final 25 games. Kicks off Friday against Minnesota and with a pretty tough 8-game stretch, all against winning opponents out of the chute. So can the Rockets hold on? Where are they at? This is our last chance to kind of talk big picture before we get back into the minutiae of day-by-day, game-by-game analysis. So to kind of give an overview of what we've learned to this point and what we're going to learn down the home stretch of this season, especially these next 8 games or so, I'm joined by a good friend, Karthik Prasad. You know him better as at StanfordKP on Twitter. We've had him on the show a few times before, but with this being kind of the perfect break point of the year, 57 games done, 25 games still to go, Rockets up by a game on the Warriors heading into these final 25, I thought it was a perfect chance to bring him back to Locked On Rockets, your home for for daily and regular commentary on the Houston Rockets. So first things first, Karthik, welcome back.
Thanks, Ben. Happy to be back, and as you said, it's an exciting time as a Rockets fan.
Yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, well, as I said, I enjoy your big picture stuff on Twitter, at StanfordKP. What are the things you put out there today that's really interesting is looking at the top 5 players for each team in this Rockets-Warriors matchup, because let's be real, everything that happens down the home stretch of this season is going to be Rockets versus Warriors. It's all viewed through that prism. And the conventional narrative is that the Warriors have these 4 all-star level players, maybe even 4 Hall of Fame level players. The Rockets only have 2, and even though the Rockets have all of this superior depth, it might not be enough come playoff team against a team that is loaded as the Warriors are. However, when you actually take a deeper look at it, and you did, you know, just one-on-one through the star five, the power five, you looked at from the Warriors' perspective, their core 4 plus Andre Iguodala. For the Rockets, I believe you did, obviously, James Harden, Chris Paul, but also Clint Capella, Eric Gordon, Luke Bamute. And so when you look at the Rockets, even if we take depth out of the picture, and depth has some relevance, even if we just look at it from the standpoint of being top-heavy, the Rockets look a little closer, especially looking at your analysis, to the Warriors in terms of how top-heavy they are than you might think based on the names. Is that a fair assessment? And tell me what you found there.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think what's most impressive is that, you know, I think Harden and Chris Paul can go toe-to-toe with Steph and Durant. We've seen that in the matchups, actually, this year. I mean, those 4 players have always played well, et cetera. I think the most interesting matchup, especially come playoff time, is Draymond Green and Clint Capella. And I don't know how much head-to-head they'll truly go, but, you know, from a center kind of big standpoint, you know, through this point in the season, they are having very similar impacts on the floor. And Clint's, you know, been a really much improved player. And I think, as you look at Draymond, I mean, he's kind of spent more time at the 4, less time at the 5. So it'll see come playoff time how that evolves. So that's one matchup, Clint versus Draymond. And then, you know, the Luke Mbamute versus Iguodala. I mean, Iguodala's having a down year, and Luke's having a great year. And I just think that, you know, the versatility both of those guys present, if you zoom out, I think are equally important. But we have now that kind of versatile forward who can really play the 3 and the 4, guard Durant, et cetera, to match up with what the Warriors have in Iguodala. So back to your question, I think it's, if you take our top 5 players through this point in the season, They've been just as good as the Warriors' top five historically, at least through this season. And so it'll be interesting to see over the next 25 games how that evolves, especially going into the playoffs.
I think that Capella-Draymond comparison is so interesting because, of course, the Rockets, they've won two out of three from the Warriors. That's why they have the tiebreaker. But if you go back to that first game that was in October, the season opener, now, Clint only played 18 minutes. He did have 12 points, 4 rebounds, 6 of 10 shooting, but a large degree of his effectiveness, if you remember, Draymond left early in the fourth quarter of that game, and Clint actually had some better success in the final 10 minutes or so of the game after that. Before, Clint was largely unplayable because of the style at which the Warriors played at. Now, as you mentioned, they haven't played Draymond at the 5 nearly as much, but they have in bits and pieces, especially against the Rockets. And one thing that I got a lot of hope out of in that January matchup, it's not just that the Rockets won the game, but it's that Clint played a big role in it. He played 30 minutes against the Warriors, had 18 points, 5 rebounds. Even the game that they lost against the Warriors earlier in January, that was the one when James Harden was out, Clint had 15 and 10 on 7 of 10 shooting, played 28 minutes. So essentially the first game, it felt like more of the same in which the Warriors were able to, with that death lineup, to kind of scheme the Rockets out of using Capella. And for the Rockets, there's just not enough talent to beat the Warriors if you don't have this elite version of Clint Capella, or near elite version, that we've had, at least from an efficiency standpoint, for majority of this year. So that's why I like your comparison there, not just, of course, how he stacks up relative to Draymond and the efficiency, but then when you look at the head-to-head matchups, how Capella, his last two against Golden State, he's been able to stay on the floor and he's been able to make an impact, because if he can do that, then that's kind of the recipe. We've all said in the past that, well, Golden State, if they have a weakness, they're not especially tough. They don't have that prototype physical big man inside. But the problem is so few teams can actually exploit that, because it's so tough to play those types of presences against the Draymond at the five lineups. Whereas now you might be seeing evidence from these last two games that Capella is finding his footing to where he's comfortable in that matchup. Is that something that you saw as well?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And his growth and consistency on the floor has been really great to watch, and it'll be something to monitor as the playoffs roll around. But implied in that, Ben, I think is this aspect of what he brings to the offense and how he diversifies it. Because when he's in there, you run a lot more spread pick and rolls, but he also offers that big threat as a roll man to the basket. And I, you know, when he's not playing as effective or he's not staying on the floor as much, we kind of revert back into, okay, let's shoot a bunch of threes, or let's ISO with James and Chris. And I think the Warriors feast on that, those situations. And so the more you can keep them on their toes, having to react to multiple layers in the defense, then I think that's where we're at our best. So you're right. I mean, it's his growth in, as an individual player, but implied in that is the impact he has on our offense and defense as a team.
To turn it back to the bigger picture, obviously we're not talking about just Capella versus the Warriors, but what it means for where the Rockets are as a franchise. Do they have a shot? And I think it's, you know, the growth of Capella, we've said from the outset that Clint, Eric Gordon, those are the two variables that if they develop, if they become something more than what we thought they were in September and October, that's how the Rockets can actually challenge this team. So as they sit here today, 44-13, ahead of the Warriors at 44-14, regardless of what happens, Warriors, Clippers tonight, the Rockets are going to be a game up in the loss column, and that's what matters with two teams that win nearly 80% of their games. But Karthik, I know there are no guarantees, and personally, I would even say it's better than 50-50. But I would say that my thoughts on whether the Rockets can take 4 out of 7, I'm significantly more bullish on it than I am before the year. If I had been asked that question in late September, October, training camp, I would have said maybe 10, 15%. You know, you have to hope that your shooters get hot in a given series. Maybe there's a timely injury that goes your way, those types of variables. Right now, especially they get home court, I'm starting to think there's close to, you know, a 40 or 50% shot that the Rockets can do this. I'm curious where you're at and, you know, where your expectations are now, big picture, Rockets versus the Warriors, compared to, you know, when we chatted in the preseason, for example, when we did our schedule analysis before the year.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. I think if you'd asked me, and when you asked me in the beginning of the season, I would have put our odds of beating the Warriors in the Western Conference Finals at 10-15%, like you said. If I had to put a number now, I think it's near 40, maybe a coin flip. And I think that home court, we kind of dismissed that possibility. We talked about it. Could they challenge for the one seed? But if they do, now all of a sudden, if you believe these two teams really are close in talent, the conventional narrative would have been no one's winning Game 7 in Oracle. And I know LeBron did it, but no one's going to win Game 7 in Oracle. But now if that Game 7 is here, you really have more than a puncher's chance if that's what it came down to. And that's why I think it's been so important, as you hear James Harden and Eric Gordon talking about that one seed a lot in the media recently. So when I zoom out and I think they ought to get to the Western Conference Finals unless something dramatic happens, that's where they should be. So should the Warriors. The two teams are head and shoulders above everyone else. And then it'll come down to the consistency of the role players. If James and Chris show up, on a game-to-game basis, and then if we have that one seed and it can have a Game 7 at home, maybe, that we should be able to have a real chance of winning. And I think that for the first time in the last 4 years, we as Rockets fans can say that.
Yeah, I would agree, because even the 2015 year when you got to the Western Conference Finals, I don't think there was a real path to taking 4 out of 7, certainly not with Jason Terry and Pablo Prigioni at the point guard, those types of things.
Right.
There's actually a path now, especially if you get home court, and besides the obvious benefits of home court, Game 1, Game 2, and especially Game 5 and Game 7, the two swing games, go back to that Spurs series last year that everyone talks about. It was the Game 5 in San Antonio that swung everything. So you kind of have those key inflection points. Those are in your gym. But the other reason it's a big deal, if you can outgun these guys over 82 games, it says a lot. I never took home court that seriously because, I thought maybe the Rockets could take 4 out of 7 if they get hot in a small sample. We've heard Daryl Morey refer to that last year, essentially trying to increase the variability by getting all these three-point shooters. And so if you increase your upside scenario, then maybe that's the ticket. But if you're actually able to catch them and beat them as they are now over 82 games, that says something else. That indicates that's a huge sample in which you were the better basketball team, and certainly in addition to the confidence that comes with that, you get the result and the reward, I should say, of having 4 out of 7, including the impact games, Game 1, Game 2, Game 5, and Game 7, at your gym at Toyota Center in Houston. So, to spin this forward, that's obviously going to be a big topic of discussion for the remainder of the year. Rockets are up a game now. How do they hold that? And there's been a lot made this week of the fact that the Warriors have an easier schedule than the Rockets do. And that's largely true. And so on paper, I saw the ESPN odds had the Warriors with like a 59% shot for the one seed compared to 41 for the Rockets. Not really based on the difference between the teams, more based on the differences in the schedule. However, my contention, if you're a Rockets fan wanting some optimism, and let's be honest, these next 8 games, starting with Minnesota Friday night, are going to be tough. But if you want to mount an optimistic case, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you look at the final 15 days before the All-Star break, Karthik, the Rockets made up 4 games, and that was without even playing the Warriors. The Warriors lost 4 times, the Rockets won all of their games, so even if the schedule is tougher, well, first off, the Rockets do have 1 game of buffer. It's not a lot of buffer, but it is something going into this hell stretch. But the other thing is that the last time we saw these two teams for the last 15 days, the Rockets have been executing at a far higher level. So I would think if you're a Rockets fan looking for optimism, it's the fact that at least the past couple of weeks, the Rockets have been in a clearly higher gear than Golden State, and perhaps that offsets the scheduling effects to some degree. Is that a reasonable characterization?
I think so, and hilariously, the only time they lost in that 15 games, Ben, was when we both saw each other at the viewing party.
Oh, yeah.
That's a different story.
Yeah.
To answer your question, I think the good thing about the Rockets' schedule, now you can talk about the next 8 games being difficult, but after those 8 games, it's pretty good. Like, it's actually very good, and there's a a home heavy stretch kind of at the end of March. That will allow them to really settle in if they have to go on another kind of 10-game streak. So I look at the schedule as a totality, and I think, okay, yeah, they can push for the next 2 weeks, see how much of these hard eight they can win. And then after that, they're not too far from a really good stretch in which they can either make up some ground or hopefully get a little bit more cushion, and while maybe getting some rest as well before the playoffs roll around.
Yeah, and the other benefit that I see from it, it is an easier close to the Rockets. We make a lot out of these next eight games, and that's true. I don't mean to downplay that. But then if you actually break it down by quadrants of the schedule, and we did this on our schedule preview last summer, but the final 10 games, you've got to stretch Atlanta, Chicago, Phoenix, San Antonio, Washington, Portland, Oklahoma City, the Lakers, the Kings. There's no heavyweights in there, and there's only a couple of even what I would say quality teams, Portland, Oklahoma City, and those are at home. The only even semi-tough road game you have in there would be at San Antonio, and who knows what that's going to look like without Kawhi Leonard. So because the schedule eases up towards the end of the year, my thought is that even if the Rockets, say, give up a couple of games to the Warriors over this eight-game stretch that's coming up, you can, first off, you can potentially make it up later, but even if you don't make it up, there's the benefit of, I don't think the Warriors are going to be able to rest guys down the stretch the way they normally do, because they know that the Rockets are going to be able, you know, the Rockets potentially have a long winning streak in their back pocket towards the end of the year, should they need it. So my thought on that is that, you know, first off, hopefully you can make up the games and get the one seed, but at a bare minimum, the way it shakes up with your weaker games towards the end, that has to kind of factor in the calculus for Steve Kerr about, even if they get, say, a two or three game lead again, can they really afford to rest someone? Because I think the Warriors have to be aware throughout this process that the Rockets have the potential to, you know, make one more run towards the latter stage.
Yeah, and that's the whole point, right? Either keep the pressure on them, make them think about the schedule, make them think about their rosters more than they have in the last 3 years. And at the same time, if you can maybe stay ahead of them, put some distance, then all of a sudden, like, to your point, there are good results that come out of us winning at a high percentage down the stretch. Not, you know, I think we'll win 20, 21 of these next 25, which would be amazing, right? If we got to 64 wins, that would be a great accomplishment for this season, but also implicitly put a lot of pressure on the Warriors to go something like 22-3 to make sure that they are ahead of us.
Yeah, and geez, anything I would say 60 or above. I mean, it's incredible how dominant this team has been, because you start thinking about these scenarios, even 16-9, which unfortunately is probably not enough for the one seed, that still puts you at a 60-win clip and is the best team in Rockets franchise history. So to be sitting at 44-13 through 57 games, that puts it in perspective as to how dominant this team is. You know, I think we'd be somewhat disappointed with 16-9 given the stakes, and even if they do that, it's still by far the winningest team in Rockets history and the only one to have ever won 60 games. So yeah, that's, wow, I mean, I just realized it running through the numbers myself, but that shows you just how dominant this team has truly been, and of course they have to be, to compete with the Warriors. Karthik, to spin it forward for kind of high level to, you know, going from, I would say, the macro to the micro, we've been talking a lot of big picture throughout the first 15 or so minutes of the program. Now I want to talk about what's actually going to be on the floor the next few nights, starting Friday night against Minnesota. And one of the really intriguing things to see is the starting lineup, because you're going to get Trevor Ariza back. And I know I've seen some folks on Clutch Fans and the like saying, well, the Rockets won all their games without Trevor. How important is he? Well, I would note that, number one, it came in a weaker stretch of the schedule. And secondly, it wasn't like the offense was perfect. You look at two of the last three games, the Dallas and the Sacramento games at home, where they went through some lulls you would not normally see them go through offensively. I think having Trevor Ariza, another 38% three-point shooter, in addition to his defensive value, he is potentially of use. And I think we know, because of his status, now his fourth season in a row here in Houston, he's going to get his spot back as the starting small forward. So I want to get your take both tomorrow night against Minnesota and also game one of the playoffs, you could start P.J. Tucker at the four, you could start Ryan Anderson at the four, or you could start Luke Bamute. Just curious your thoughts on who it's going to be tomorrow and who you think it is in that spot alongside Trevor Ariza, Clint Capela, and obviously James Harden and Chris Paul when the playoffs roll around.
Yep. I think my answer to both, honestly, is Luka Bamute. I think especially on Friday, given the types of personnel that Minnesota has with Butler and Wiggins on the perimeter, that they're going to kind of want Ariza and Luke chasing those guys, and I think they can stick Harden on Gibson. And in general, I think that that's the best lineup for this team. They can run the floor, still get a lot of threes, and you always have kind of those two premier wing stoppers in addition to Chris Paul. I think, in addition to that, Ryan Anderson, I think his role on the bench is increasingly being solidified. I think he plays well with Chris and Eric. So then the question becomes, what do you do with P.J. Tucker? Are you really comfortable moving him out of the starting lineup? But I think he fits well with that bench unit and can kind of float in between those lineups. And so that to me is where I would go. Now, maybe they kind of mix and match depending on their different games night in and night out. But for come playoff time, I would have to believe that they'll settle on Luke, just given his impact on the floor. I mean, it's been consistent throughout the entire year that he's every time he steps on the court. So that's where my head is at.
I agree with you, at least in part. I think the Ryan Anderson off the bench, I think that's optimal for him, especially because you can sort of hide his defensive deficiencies by putting him up against second teamers. I've said for a while that while Mike D'Antoni tried to play it off, I think, you know, they may say that it's experimenting or whatever else. The reality, this is something they've been wanting to do for some time, and his minor injury kind of just gave them the political cover to make the move. I don't expect it to be Ryan. Personally, I completely agree with you. In theory, I'm wondering if it's going to be P.J. Tucker with a quick hook. The only reason I say that, now P.J. has gotten the start at the four recently, although in D'Antoni's offense, I mean, the forward spots are kind of interchangeable anyway, so I'm not necessarily sure how much that proves. You can say earlier in the year they started P.J. and not Luke when they experimented with bringing Ryan off the bench. But the reason I wonder a little bit about starting PJ is because if you start Luke at the four, then you have to figure out how you're going to work in both PJ and Ryan all at one position. But I guess the counter to that is that D'Antoni is not overly worried about exact positions anyway. The Rockets, as they say, they really have just three positions. They have point guards, they have wings, and they have rim runners. So I think maybe some fans look at this a little too rigid in terms of the boxes. The other reason that I would be a little, and this does tie into it a little bit, the positions a little bit, PJ, while he can play some minutes at the three, he's certainly not as versatile as Luke is. So my initial fear with starting Luke at the four would be that, okay, well, if he's at the four and Trevor's at the three and you play both of those guys at the start of each half for a while, do you trust what you have off the bench at the wing spots to properly hedge, because you're kind of skewing bigger on your bench if both PJ and Ryan are there? But I guess the counter argument you could make to that is because you suddenly have so much depth now, you now have both Joe Johnson and Gerald Green that are at least somewhat wings. Gerald definitely is, Joe at least partially. So maybe because that depth, maybe that's the cover to start Luke at the four, as opposed to something, you know, say earlier this year, if you tried it in December, which as I mentioned earlier, that was the scenario the last time that conceivably you could have started Luke, but they went with PJ, maybe now that extra depth gives you more cover fire to make Luke your starting four. Is that reasonable? Because I kind of feel like just talking the last couple of minutes, leading into the conversation, I was going to say I expected it to be PJ, but the more I think about it, just running through the scenarios in my head, I think this actually makes sense. If you use, you know, Joe and or Gerald, then maybe all of a sudden it makes more sense there. You see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I leaned towards Luke initially at the four. The only thing that they'll probably think about is the fact that if you have one of Ariza and Luke on the floor at any given time, along with Chris, then you have the backbones of like a really good perimeter defense on the court at any time. And the worry is in starting both Ariza and Luke is that you reduce kind of the overlap in their minutes means that at some point you will have neither of them on the floor. So that may be the only thing that they'll think about in terms of if every unit, similar to the way they use logic around James and Chris having an elite point guard on the floor, they want an elite wing stopper at any given point, then that's why they might start PJ and say, okay, well, we'll bring Luke off the bench pretty early, and then that way we just have a full coverage. That could be the other side of this. So it'll be interesting. I mean, I think it'll prove itself out over 25 minutes, 25 games. And to your point, kind of the additions of Joe and in addition to Gerald Green means that we'll have enough offense. I mean, I'm not worried about the offense now as it relates to the bench. It's more just how do we have the defensive consistency, especially if you generate leads with your first unit and stuff like that to make sure the bench units are effective.
Yeah, and I think either way, you're certainly going to have more of a defensive presence at the four, and that makes all the sense in the world because we all know why Ryan Anderson was signed in July 2016, but now that you have this team, which through the All-Star break is ranking as arguably the best offense in the history of the league, well, folks, taking Ryan Anderson out of your starting lineup is not going to be a dramatic hit to that. As opposed to defensively, the upgrade to either Luke or PJ is pretty substantial. So certainly it makes sense for it not to be Ryan and to use him as the quintessential microwave off the bench. And it's just a matter of exactly how they want to stagger the minutes for the others. But ultimately, it's a good problem to have. The Rockets have so many quality options, so much depth that you could map out a scenario for starting Luke or starting PJ. And you'd still be worried about exactly how you're going to get minutes for everybody because up and down the roster, there's just so many places that they could turn. Karthik, before we close out the program, we haven't actually talked about James Harden that much. We've talked so much about the minutia, certainly rotation recently, but then matching up with the Warriors, the Capella versus Draymond. We spent a lot of time talking about the variables, and that's generally because we tend to take the stars for granted. And I'm sure Chris and James are fine with that because they're pretty entrenched in who they are in NBA circles. James coming off an All-Star game appearance this weekend and clearly the league's MVP frontrunner. And I want to talk about, A, how great of a season he's really having because certainly it's historic, but B, is this the year that he finally gets it done from an MVP standpoint? I know that's secondary, but it's not irrelevant because, folks, MVP awards, they do lead perception. They do mean things. And so if James can get this award leading into a summer, which we know they're going to be after LeBron James, if not LeBron, we know how aggressive Daryl is every single year. And above all else, I'm sure it would just be another reward that James works very hard for and has wanted for some time. So there's plenty of reason to want it. Of course, in the past, James has gotten very close, finished second to Stephen Curry in 2015, second to Russell Westbrook last year. And so I know there's a segment of Rockets Twitter that just kind of waits for the other shoe to drop. But I don't know about you. I just can't really see, barring a catastrophic injury or meltdown in the standings, as long as the Rockets are even in the top two, to me, I can't really see a scenario where James Harden doesn't win the award. And as opposed to last year, I know if you had asked me last year, and I'm sure if we'd had a podcast, we would have both said in late February that James was the front runner, but you could at least see a path to where Russell Westbrook, with the triple-double average, coming out the narrative of losing Kevin Durant, you could see a path to where Russell could take it, even if he wasn't the front runner. Right now, I'm struggling to see a path for anyone other than James Harden, assuming, of course, that there's no, as we said, catastrophic injury, meltdown, something just completely unexpected. So I'll turn this over to you, but you can talk, A, statistically about what James has done, and B, just your thoughts on the narrative. Is there any way that James doesn't win it this year?
Yeah. Well, the facts currently are that the Rockets have the best record in the NBA. James is the best statistical player in the NBA. And from an eye test perspective, he's had a lot of clutch moments, a lot of big wins, and has played the best to this point. So you're right. As where we stand now on February 22nd, he is the absolute MVP frontrunner on all dimensions, winning, stats, impact, eye test, whatever. Now, the only person that I can see challenging him for the award is LeBron James. Because, and everyone said that, but like if you think about it and you take the narrative, right? He lost Kyrie. Everyone thought he would have Isaiah. Isaiah didn't work out. They traded him, gave him a whole new cast of characters, and if all of a sudden they just start winning at an incredible pace and maybe retake that one seed and LeBron goes on a tear, I could see it. I could see that voters would be torn at the very least. And the thing about, well, both James Harden and LeBron James is that they've actually been really good for so long that you kind of don't know when and how to reward them. And LeBron, everyone uses the argument, well, he's been the best player in the NBA for the last 10 years. So at some point, you should have all the MVPs. So why not this year? And then for James, it's been, yeah, he's been close. But he's, you know, it's never really quite worked out. And I can see a scenario in which if Cleveland goes on a run that, you know, people start talking about it more because folks just want to give LeBron another award. But that being said, I mean, if James continues and the Rockets continue and they're battling for the one seed, they continue to win primetime games, they kind of display that awesome team chemistry they have, I have to think that James is the favorite. And that's what's been so rewarding. And isn't it kind of ironic that the season in which he actually gets a real second star and that he really doesn't campaign as much for himself, nor does the Rockets campaign for him as much, that he might actually win. And maybe that's what's meant to be. And so a long-winded way of saying he is the favorite now, as he should be, and the only threat, and it's a distant one, is LeBron and the Cavs going on a major run.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I can't remember if we pointed out on this show, but last week the Washington Post did its first version of its regular media tracking poll. Of the 100 media members they surveyed, 91 voted for Harden, which is pretty strong. I would agree with you that LeBron's the only one with a semi-path, but fortunately I don't see it as realistic unless they get that one seed, as you said, because they're certainly not going to catch the Rockets. Cavs now at 22 losses, Rockets at 13. Harden also had the head-to-head sweep over LeBron, so it's not at all reasonable for the Cavs to catch the Rockets. I mean, the only hope that I could see to build a narrative is if they somehow track down Toronto for the East, but I find that to be unlikely because they're six games back now. The Raptors, say what you will about playoff performance, but right now they are a machine. They've won seven in a row, plus 8.5 point differential. So it seems like a real far-fetched, after just a couple of good games, to see the Cavaliers making up a six-game gap, actually six-and-a-half-game gap, with only 25 games left. That's the only way you could see it. Even then, they wouldn't have as good of a record as the Rockets. But I guess the bottom line is it's very unlikely. You would have to see them just play at an incredibly high clip. And I don't know about you. I think the Cavaliers are better, but I don't buy the narrative. They're just completely fixed based on those wave of trades. I think it's enough to get them competitive, to get them some juice. And who knows, maybe that's enough to keep LeBron for another year if they show something in the playoffs. But as far as catching the Raptors, making up 6.5 games, that's the only scenario I can see to even start with LeBron having an MVP angle. And then the amazing thing, Karthik, amazing thing to me is that even if they do all of that, somehow if the Rockets stay ahead of the Warriors and get the one seed in the West, then I don't know how you would trump James. And to me, there's obviously a much better odds of the Rockets beating the Warriors than there are of the Cavaliers catching Toronto. So either way, I guess you can't say it's impossible, but it's pretty far-fetched for James Harden not to win it this year.
Yep, and I jokingly tweeted a couple months ago that, you know, we had Altuve, the Astros MVP, if we could get Harden this year, and going 2-for-2 would be one thing, but that opens the door then for 3-for-3 at some point across the Houston sports major teams. And you step back and you're just, wow, I mean, we are lucky as fans. It's going to be hopefully a great 3 to 4 months down the stretch here. And James is just having an incredible season on and off the court. And so I'm excited.
Yep. Deshaun Watson will hopefully get a chance, assuming he stays healthy. Knock on wood. I literally knocked on wood there. But 3-for-3 would be something special. And I think you also hit the nail on the head. in terms of discussing Harden, it's the moments. That's what separates him this year. Because if you remember last year, well, of course, Westbrook had his share of big moments. And I think when he won it was that game against Denver that I think he had like a 50-point triple-double and hit a 35-foot three at the buzzer to win the game. As opposed to the Rockets, they didn't have that many close games. But for whatever reason, Harden's performance late in close games was actually not good. The clutch metrics were kind of an argument against it. Whereas this year, it's completely flipped. And I don't necessarily think that Harden is that much better himself. It might just be the presence of Chris Paul makes them less predictable, yada, yada. But whatever the reason, he has been better late in close games. He's had the moments, most notably the step back and the block that he had to close out that last Warriors game. And then because of that, he's getting the praise from the media that maybe he did not fully get a year ago. And as frustrated as Rockets fans get with the media nationally, I think the one thing you can say, at the very least, they've been consistent to this point, and they still have to follow through with the vote. But to this point, they've been consistent. They've given James his due as the team has won more as they've had those moments. And so that's why, beyond just the obvious metrics, which have been there all along, that, yeah, I think I'm right there with you that this is going to be James's year from an individual standpoint. And certainly, as we mentioned earlier, that award does have real value beyond just honoring James. I think it certainly means something for his perception, recruiting, all the other things the Rockets are trying to do to make this a destination franchise. And, well, what it certainly appears to be at the moment, considering the recent additions of Joe Johnson and Brandon Wright, the first two big dominoes in the buyout market to fall, each choosing Houston. Anyway, on that note, I will wrap up. Karthik, as always, thank you for joining us. For our followers who are not with you already, tell folks where they can find you on Twitter.
Yep. Thanks, Ben. I'm at StanfordKP on Twitter. As always, this has been an amazing conversation, and thanks for having me on. And looking forward to the rest of the season.
Sure thing. For the rest of you guys, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do so at Ben Dubose. As Karthik mentioned, he's at StanfordKP. And don't forget, the show is at Locked On Rockets. All great avenues to contact us. Also, LockedOnRockets.com, Facebook.com/LockedOnRockets, and LockedOnRockets@gmail.com. All ways you can interact with me, give us suggestions for the show, questions about the team, anything we can do to make this a better podcast for you, the diehard Rockets fan. So, folks, until tomorrow night, I will wrap it right there. Again, I'm Ben Dubose. This is Locked On Rockets. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be talking again tomorrow as the Rockets finally get back after 8 consecutive days off to basketball, hosting the Minnesota Timberwolves, 7 p.m. tip Houston time, nationally televised on ESPN. Should be a lot of fun. I'll talk to you about it on Twitter during the game, and then, of course, after it, we'll be right here breaking it all down at Locked On Rockets, your home for daily coverage of Houston Rockets basketball.